Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
Typo! Errors! I can't hear you, I'm wearing headphones! You have to cut this out. You're not getting a lot of usable audio right now.
I'm JP, and this is another edition of Sound Waves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and we're one of the oldest independent publications in the U.S., distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and subculture. We even have articles on everything from local cycling to beers and even CD reviews. On this week's episode, the Doom and Gloom Fest, Tap It Water, and Boys of Bonneville. Doom and Gloom Fest is a yearly hard rock festival that launched last year with a two-day event at Burt's Tiki Lounge downtown. This year, the festival expands to 5 days with bands like Invaders, Eagle Twin, Castle Axe, All Systems Fail, Cornered by Zombies, Holdra, and more. We have a full entertainment listing in our daily calendar section here in just a little bit. Right now, though, we're going to be listening to junior editor Alex Ortega speaking with Burt's manager Germ about the event.
Hold on loose, I said, hold on tight, yeah.
Tell us about Doom and Gloom Fest. First, what is it?
Doom and Gloom Fest, I'm just trying to do an annual thing where all the anything heavy, stoner rock, doom, metal, anything heavy, get as many bands as we can. I actually try to get some more out of, you know, some national acts on the bill. But
nice.
There's so many local bands on the bill. Last year was only 2 days. This year is we're doing five.
And so why did you decide to start Doom and Gloom?
Basically because I see all these other Doom Fest going on in Denver and Amsterdam. They do one every year, and I just thought, why not do one here? We got enough of a scene to facilitate it.
You've done it once before. Last year was the first year, right?
Yes.
And how did Doom and Gloom Fest fare last year?
Great. We had two great nights, except for tried to do seven bands one night and I think eight the next, and it was just, that was the only downfall, is trying to get those bands on and off at the same time.
Right.
In time to do it in one night, but yeah.
Hence why you picked to do it for 5 days this year instead of two.
Right. With
nice.
Six or five bands. That's
more doable.
Still, yeah.
Yeah. And what was the turnout like last year?
It was good. It was packed both nights. We did. I know that Eagle Twin and we played last one night. And the Invaders did. Invaders did the second night. It was both nights were packed. I can't remember the turnout or any numbers, but.
It was enough to pack the house.
Yeah.
So this year it's 5 days, and what else is different for this year as opposed to last year?
Just being there's a lot more bands, there's a lot more to choose from, and I don't know. Other than that, just more bands, I guess.
Cool. And is it just you that's organizing these showcases, or are there others involved?
No, it's been me these 2 years. I love the heavy side of the local scene. And,
right.
And I,
you know, who doesn't?
I'm more of a metalhead, so this is right up my alley. And last year I was in a band called Muckraker, and since we kind of disbanded, but that was one of the other reasons for putting it together, is putting other bands like, you know, heavy stuff that Muckraker, Old Timer, and Jesus, and all those bands.
The lineup is really heavy this year, like Eagle Twin, All Systems Fail, Invaders, and Gaza are all invited. So is it just your personal liking that draws you to these heavier bands, or is there something else that compels you to organize a fest like this?
The main reason is, my personal likings. I like that's what I really enjoy about the live music scene in Salt Lake, is bands like you just mentioned, Invaders and Gaza.
Right.
That's what I wish was more prominent rather than some of the clicky seamster shit, you know?
Right. Kind of keeping it real, keeping it heavy.
Yeah.
Because we do have a lot of that here.
Yeah, we'll get the action, baby. Moving to the front of the line.
considerations do you make when you look for bands for Doom and Gloom?
I just basically put the word out to as many, all the heavy bands that I wanted to book and see what comes back. I mean, there's a lot of bands that I did hit up and want on the bill, like Nine Worlds and stuff like that, but then they broke up, and other bands, they couldn't do it. But for the most part, this year, seems like everybody's more into it because it went so well last year, so I'm getting more bands saying they want to play the thing rather than the amount we had last year.
You book shows for Bert's Tiki Lounge, and so it seems natural that you'd book Doom and Gloom here. But also, though, Bert's hosts many heavier type rock acts. Is there any significance you would attach to holding Doom and Gloom at Bert's Tiki Lounge?
Yeah, I definitely think that, being that Bert's has always been kind of a more of a punk rock dive bar, DIY, but we've always kind of leaned towards that, and the rockabilly goes good, and a few other genres here, but for the main part, I've always kind of steered away from booking because I'm a metalhead, and I know the way what worked here at the bar, but I'm just glad that it seems like nowadays everything's kind of shifted, and now the heavier stuff does go well here at Bert's. It seems kind of like the scene's kind of shifted.
Uh-huh. Kind of seems like, rather than everyone saying, I'm a metalhead or I'm a punk, like people kind of get along more than they used to,
yeah,
as well.
Definitely, too. I think that, too, because you got so many bands that are more crossover, you know?
Yeah.
Like Desolate, who's playing, they're kind of on the verge of being, they remind me of, like, the Accused and stuff, but then they're definitely on the heavier side of the grind.
Yeah.
As well, so.
Definitely an eclectic mix of heavier styles with Desolate. Other than throwing a killer series of metal and hardcore shows, is there anything you aim to accomplish via Doom and Gloom Fest?
I'd like it to be an annual thing that people seek after, and hopefully, like in the next couple of years, maybe I can get hit up by bigger bands, you know, coming in that are heavier, stuff that maybe wouldn't make an exception to come here for this event, you know?
Right. So kind of grow it in prominence and
right.
Get noticed,
yeah,
nationally
and
internationally.
Not to mention the Crucial Fest was definitely somewhat of an inspiration to do it too, because they don't necessarily go just for the heavier stuff like Doom and Gloom is, but it's definitely a lot of those same type bands.
Right. Geared toward more of an aggressive underground,
right,
perhaps. What do you hope Doom and Gloom does for the community?
I just hope that more and more heavier bands grow out of it and becomes more of a scene and more people come out for the shows and more of the thing to do.
Doom and Gloom Fest kicks off on July 19th with at least 5 bands playing every night until July 23rd. For more info, search for Bert's Tiki Lounge on Facebook or listen to our upcoming daily calendar segment. Old Timer is a heavy rock band from Salt Lake that formed in 2007, then released their debut album Lost in the Tracks in September of 2009. The band have spent the past 3 years playing occasional gigs and working on recordings in their spare time, and they recently released a new live single, Warbringer. They recorded this at Bert's. That was Old Timer with Warbringer. They'll be playing the Doom and Gloom Festival on July 19th with Laughter, Dunn, Top Dead Celebrity, and Dwellers. For more information on the band, visit them online at oldtimertheband.com. Tap It is a program encouraging people to use tap water rather than buying wasteful bottled water. Local businesses sign up on a website and offer their service of free tap water for people that stop in. Today we're chatting with Bridget Stuckley, the Outreach Program Manager for the Division of Sustainability and the Environment at Salt Lake City Corporation. Thank you for joining us, Bridget.
Thanks for having me.
How did Salt Lake City first become aware of the Tap It program?
We were actually approached by Tap It. They've been really successful in New York City. And they were reaching out to other cities that they've noticed that had really aggressive sustainability agendas. And we were doing a lot to try to increase awareness around reducing the amount of bottled water that was used. So they got in touch with us to see if we might be one of their next pilot cities.
And judging by what I saw on the website when I searched for Salt Lake City under the Find Water tab at tapitwater.com, it's going pretty well. I found 102 locations in Salt Lake City alone, ranging from coffee shops to delis. How do you find the community responding to the program?
So far, so good. People have been excited that they have places to go fill up their water, you know, especially when we have hot summers like we're having right now, for people to have the option to just go into a restaurant when they otherwise would feel a little timid about approaching someone to refill their water bottle. So they're getting pretty excited about it. And the fact that it's so accessible on your iPhone or Android just makes it a whole lot easier.
And some people drink bottled water because they think some tap water tastes bad or may not be as sanitary in certain areas. Is that a valid fear in any parts of Utah? And what do you say to those people?
You know, in Utah, it's not at all. I think that it's a perception that a lot of people have, but we're really lucky, especially in Salt Lake City and even along other areas of the valley, that we're so close to our water source. So we really have high quality of water here. And the other thing people don't realize about bottled water is that it's not regulated as much as our tap water is. And 25% of bottled water is actually tap water. So here you're paying a premium for something that you could have just gotten out of your tap.
And wasteful plastic practices kind of add to people wanting to get involved with the bottled water thing. I think that's probably the main thing. What would be a good estimate of how many water bottles in the U.S. are wasted each day on a single use, if you could?
Well, you know, I know that on a weekly basis, we go through about a 500 million bottles of water.
And it's pretty crazy.
It's totally nuts. And that also only 80% of those bottles are actually getting recycled. So all of that's going into our landfills.
And we have to talk about, and I like how you address it on the website. There's the top 10 things about bottled water you should know, I believe is what the infographic's called. You click on that and one of the illustrations is how many bottles of water it actually takes to make one bottle of water in terms of petrochemical processing. And it's ridiculous. It's something like 4 times as much water is needed even just to make that bottle.
Yeah, what we don't think about is everything that goes into actually extracting the water, bottling it, getting that water to us from wherever it's coming from. So there's a huge, huge oil cost attached to that.
And what kind of bottles are best to refill? I know there's some negative side effects that you might get from repeatedly filling up single-use bottles that you might find in most grocery stores. In terms of plastic leakage, there's some negative health effects, rather. What would you recommend to refill?
You know, I use a stainless steel water bottle. And I like it because it keeps it cool, it's clean and refreshing, and you don't have to worry about heat fluctuations so much with stainless steel. If you have a plastic bottle, they're just a little bit more sensitive to heat, and then you do have to worry about leaching and other health concerns.
And I've noticed that you brought your own, that's it right there, the aforementioned stainless steel bottle, which is great for radio. I'm pointing at a bottle, she's holding a bottle. It says 20 ounce, 600 milliliters on it. Very cute little water droplet that says Mr. Tap. Where can people find bottles like that where they can refill?
Well, everywhere nowadays. I feel like you could go into your average grocery store or REI or any sort of store and you can find a stainless steel reusable bottle.
And from the other side of this, from the non-consumer side, the business side, how can local businesses get involved with providing customers tap water through Tap It?
Yeah, that's a great question. You can go to tapitwater.com and any business can sign up there, and it takes about 15 seconds and then they're up and going on the website, and then we'll come out and give them decals as well as advertise them as a business where people can get free tap water.
You mentioned earlier the different platforms that the app is available on, both Android and the iPhone. How easy is that to use, and does it offer some sort of GPS sort of tracking showing you the nearest place to get water?
It does. It's really user friendly, and that's a good question about the GPS. Actually, I don't know.
Probably Google Maps, right?
Yeah, there is some sort of Google Map function. Unfortunately, I'm not such a techie that I understand all the different intricacies of it. But
it's another gotcha moment on Slug Soundwaves. I'm right. Joking.
But if I can use it and I have no technical skills, then just about anybody can.
That's pretty good. Yeah. And how do your personal beliefs align with the TAPIT program and philosophy? Are you interested in this?
Very much so. You know, my background is in environmental science, so I try to do whatever I can to reduce the waste that I'm producing, reuse whatever I can, and really live a low-impact lifestyle.
I wanted to address something we mentioned kind of earlier about the safety of tap water. Why do you think so many consumers seem to think that bottled water is safer than tap water? Is this some sort of marketing that people are succumbing to?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. You know, when bottled water first came out, there was a huge marketing push around how it's safer and healthier for you. The bottled water industry has been incredibly effective at just pushing that message down all these different areas to make us think that it's not safe. And you know, there are areas of the world where there is, you know, water is unsafe, but we're lucky to live in a country where that's not an issue.
And we kind of just addressed this, but I've read that bottled water may be the only solution in certain places like Africa in terms of potability and portability. So bottled water isn't all bad, I guess you could say. It's just types of situations, rather.
I think we need to be cognizant of where bottled water is appropriate and where we need that type of infrastructure. The problem is that a lot of our bottled water is actually coming from areas where we're privatizing water in places that need that water, and then we're bringing it to us when we don't really need it. So I would say overall there's exceptions to everything. The dominant users of bottled water are those that have access to clean water.
Seems ridiculous. Sorry to editorialize, but
no, I agree.
Firmly against bottled water, so I'm really glad that we have this program here in Salt Lake now. Great. What's the future of bottled water in America and in the world in general, would you say?
Gosh, you know, that's a really good question. Programs like TAPIT, they're picking up speed, and a lot of cities have jumped on board since we started. So I think that people are going to continue to have other options besides bottled water. And I think that bottled water isn't going to always be as accessible and as affordable as it is now. You know, we have a luxury right now with the way that we can access a lot of things, but with the price of oil rising, so are the price of a lot of things, including, you know, food and water. I hope with that, and then just the perception of bottled water changing and people realizing how wasteful it is as they get educated about the impacts, will help shift us all away from it.
I used to see, you know, it was a cool thing to drink bottled water or something, and that seems to be a trend that's changing with the younger generation, with the older ones as well. Now it's kind of a turnoff, actually, so.
Yeah, and I think it's cool to have your own water bottle and be able to personalize it, and then people, they get attached to it, they take care of it, they want to use it, so.
Yeah, I have the same. I have a glass bottle that's wrapped in bamboo, and it's
nice.
One of my favorite things because it's so convenient and it tastes a lot better than anything that ever comes out of plastic.
It does, definitely.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would just encourage everyone to also visit our slcgreen.com website for other information about bottled water as well as different environmental programs we have.
Thank you so much for joining us, Bridget. For more information on the program, visit tapitwater.com. Today, we are joined once more for our weekly daily calendar roundup with contributing editor Ricky Vigil. Thanks for joining us, Ricky.
Thanks, JP. I thought it was a rundown, not a roundup.
Did I say roundup?
Yeah, I didn't know that we were like herding daily calendar dates like some junior rodeo thing.
Yeah, we got a bunch of steer.
Oh, okay.
Imagine that we're in a field and that these events have horns.
I'm totally imagining that now.
It's radio, it's theater of the mind, Ricky.
It is.
Okay. Let's jump right into the roundup.
Let's jump.
Tuesday, July 17th, we've got Music at Maine. It's another edition of this popular event. The Animals, No, and Dark Seas will be at Library Square, which it's a really fun event. It's free.
Yeah.
It's in their little amphitheater there.
Yeah, it's a fun way to spend a summer night. I endorse this event. Stamp of approval.
Can we cut that out so we can put that on all sorts of things?
I think we should.
Ricky Vigil endorses this and that.
Yeah.
Everything you don't endorse. Great.
I'd do it.
Thank you for that soundbite.
Oh, you got it.
And Wednesday, July 18th, there's a cool film that's going to be playing at the UMFA. Do you know anything about The Boys of Bonneville?
I know that it's a film about the Bonneville Salt Flats, the cars that race down there and break all the crazy records. This is part of some sort of film series.
It's called Speed.
Speed. Is it part of the event that they're doing?
Yep.
Okay, there's a really cool exhibit up at the UMFA. Is that how you say it? Is that a real thing?
You can say that, or the UMFA, or the UMFA. Okay. I think that's how technically you're supposed to say
it. Yeah, well, it's a cool exhibit that has a bunch of the cars that have been down at the Bonneville Salt Flats and broken a bunch of speed records. So yeah, if you're into cars, if you're into movies, this seems like a match made in heaven for you.
I went to one the other week. I went to, I think it's Le Mans. Le Mans. It was a movie about the French race. It's really cool because I peeked my head in the gallery. There's actual cars in there.
Yeah.
It's really cool. If you're into cars, I'm not really, but there's some shiny stuff.
They still look cool. Yeah.
Exactly. Thursday, July 19th. I think you probably know more about this than I do. Why don't you tell people what's going on at Burt's?
Okay, so this is a big multi-day event happening at Burt's. It's called the Doom and Gloom Fest. The first night is Thursday, July 19th. We have Ninth Zealot, which features Slug Rider Gavin Hoffman on drums. Laughter, who features former Slug Rider Andrew Roy on guitar and vocals. And we also have Doan, Top Dead Celebrity, Old Timer, and Dwellers all at Burt's. So it's a bunch of the more heavy kind of bands in Salt Lake, kind of representing that scene that's really kind of burgeoning right now. It's a really cool event.
I should mention that we've covered this in an earlier segment on this show. Oh. So go back, listen to that interview. And this calendar section, though, has more information in terms of lineup and stuff.
Yeah, I should listen to that.
Yeah, you'd like it. And
oh, wait, I have another event on Thursday,
what?
July 19th.
Bring it.
It is a Twilight Concert Series concert. It is Nas and Tiny Tempa. I think it's actually really cool that they got Nas. He's a really big name. Arguably, I wouldn't agree with this, but a lot of people would say he might be the best rapper going right now.
I think he would agree with you. I don't know.
Want to know a Nas fun fact?
Sure.
Okay, so Nas, birth name Nasir Jones, co-wrote a few of the songs on Will Smith's 1998 mega hit album, Big Willie Style, including Getting Jiggy With It.
Know that,
Most Ricky. People don't know that.
Thank you for that fun fact.
Yeah.
That is a really fun fact. And Friday, July 20th, the Celebration of the Hand opening. It's at Broadway and 300 South. You know a little bit more about this as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, so our friends at Craft Lake City started a Kickstarter campaign to fund this really cool project they're doing. They asked a few local artists to decorate these big metal signs that are just kind of sticking out of the ground at Broadway. So we have a few Craft Lake City artists who created original pieces of art for this. And on this day, they are having an opening celebration where they'll be showcasing their new work on the side of the street on Broadway.
That's really, really cool. It's yeah. always fun to see different infrastructure blossoming downtown.
Yeah.
And there's another day of the Doom and Gloom Fest that's taking place. You want to give us that lineup?
Yeah, this is actually a really great lineup. If you can only go one day, I suggest going this day. We have Huldra, Cornered by Zombies, Desolate, All Systems Fail, Invaders, and Eagle Twin at Burt's. We actually have features on All Systems Fail, Invaders, and Eagle Twin in the July issue of Slug. Take a gander at those. Get your neck all stretched out for some headbanging. Limber up.
People always forget that you have to hold each side stretch of the neck for at least 20 seconds or it's not going to do you any good.
I wasn't aware. I'm doing like 8 seconds.
No, buddy. Okay. 20 or more. Preferably a minute per side.
Okay, I'll
and
try
then,
harder.
And then down, never go back. Never
go back?
Never stretch
okay.
back. That's not good for your neck.
Okay.
And then make some circles. You can make some circles, but without pressure. It's from the Headbanging Bible. I've got a copy.
I could use that, actually.
Do you want to give us the birthdays for that day?
Sure. We have James Orme, who's one of our awesome writers. He wrote the July cover story on Boha. So happy birthday, James. And then we also have Matt. But Matt helps out with a lot of Craft Lake City stuff, too. He always wears a San Francisco Giants hat. I actually did not recognize him one day when he came in the office and he wasn't wearing it. So happy birthday, Matt. That's my little anecdote about Matt.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's a good one. And Saturday, July 21st, it's another day of the Doom and Gloom Fest featuring Loom, Gaza, Sure Sign of the Nails, Settle Down, Jesus, and Day Hymns. And Sunday, July 22nd, we've got another lineup. Why don't you give us the rundown on that?
Yet another day of the Doom and Gloom Fest. We have Filth Lords, Dust Bloom, Hypernova Holocaust, Chain Whip, Nebuchadnezzar, and Death Blow. So yeah, that's a pretty good way to spend a Sunday night.
Celebrating the Lord's kind of music.
Yeah, we also have that day. Happy birthday, Jared Smith. he is one of our illustrators. He was also on the cover of Slug, doing a rad grind on a skateboard on top of a roof right across from the Urban Lounge.
And Monday, July 23rd, another day of the Doom and Gloom Fest, the last one, Year of the Wolf, Castle Axe, Visigoth, Burn Your World, and All That Bleeds. You can find that at Burt's. Of course, we've got an app you can check out for our daily calendar for the iPhone. We have it on our website, the front page there at slugmag.com, and you can find it in the back of any Slug magazine. There's last few pages usually dedicated to the daily calendar. Any advice about how people can get us that information, Ricky?
Yes, please, if you have an event, please email it to our email address, dailycalendar@slugmag.com. Please do it before the 25th of the previous month, and we will totally put it in the magazine. We might talk about it on the podcast. I feel like I said please about 5 times during that.
Well, we need to let people know that we really appreciate their events, because that's what makes the events section work so well. People sending us in their events. We don't search the information out. It all comes to us, and we really appreciate them.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
I think this was the longest Daily Calendar segment we've ever done on metal shows.
Probably.
And it's really good that you're here as a contributing member of Napalm Flesh.
Esther would not have known what was up.
She wouldn't have known at all.
No.
She would have called Huldra like Huldra or something.
Yeah, like hooligans or something.
So ridiculous.
Yeah, cornered by zombies.
Thanks, Ricky.
No problem.
Gaza is a metal band from Salt Lake City that formed in 2004 and released their debut EP, East, shortly after. Since then, the group has completed 2 US tours, one with Converge, and released the albums I Don't Care Where I Go When I Die in 2006, and He Is Never Coming Back in 2009. This week, the group is back with the 3rd full-length album, No Absolutes in Human Suffering. From the album No Absolutes in Human Suffering, here's Mostly Hair and Bones Now from Gaza. From the album No Absolutes in Human Suffering, that was Gaza's Mostly Hair and Bones Now. For more info on the band in general, visit them online at facebook.com/gazamusic. Boys of Bonneville is a 2011 documentary film primarily about setting speed records on the Bonneville Salt Flats in western Utah. A century ago, driver David Abbott Jenkins set out to break every land speed record and successfully did so, with still unbreakable records to this day. In this film, his son Marv sets out to restore his car, dubbed the Mormon Meteor, back to specs for a ceremonial lap around the Salt Flats. Most recently, the film won Best Documentary at the 2012 Best of State Awards. Slug writer Sean Mayer sat down with director Kurt Wallen to talk about the film.
For those who haven't seen the movie, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, it's the story of Ab Jenkins. Ab was the man who was the pioneer of the Bonneville Salt Flats racing. He was also the mayor of Salt Lake in the early 40s. So simply, it's about the Mormon Meteor race car that he helped build with Augie Duesenberg. Kind of goes through the entire evolution of racing on the Salt Flats. It's a father-son story about his son Marv, who used to race with him out there. He was his mechanic. And how his son decided to rebuild the car all the way up until the mid-1990s and put it back. Well, he really took it back to his house in St. George to rebuild the engine and such. Realized that he didn't have the technology to redo that. John Price, a local businessman here in Salt Lake, bought the car just about 5-6 years ago and decided, let's rebuild the engine together. So he put the money up for that and did it, and we took the car back out to the Salt Flats again and drove it, and also back to Indianapolis Speedway, where it was originally built. It was Indianapolis and first driven. That's what it's about. Endurance racing is really what it's about. Driving 24 hours at a time.
What inspired you to make this movie? Why did you decide to tackle this project?
I was approached by John Price to do a 20-minute video for his new car museum that's downtown Salt Lake. It'll open up this fall, about 30 cars, and this was going to be the big premier car. So he said, yeah, 20-minute looping video would be great, Kurt, kind of talking about how we're going to rebuild this engine and just some pictures of the old car. So he sent me down to meet Marv down in St. George. And when I went down there, Marv had a big box sitting there that he hadn't looked in for years. I don't know what's in it, Kurt. So I pulled the thing out, opened it up, and there are 10,000 feet of film.
Nice.
And so we got that transferred and realized we had a lot more than a 20-minute thing. We had a real documentary on our hands. So we, in that film, we have the first footage out on the Salt Flats that was ever motion picture footage. It's pretty amazing to see that. So, yeah, that's why I did it. And why not?
Yeah, when did that movie premiere?
April 2011 at Sarasota Film Festival in Florida. We chose that one. Our executive producer, Geraldine Dreyfus, felt like that one fit very nicely. We finished the film to hit the circuit starting in the spring, not a winter type of start. So we started then, went to 32 festivals, I think.
So it was perceived pretty well then.
It was, yeah. We won some awards, probably half a dozen awards. There's a new festival here called Doc Utah in St. George. That's a fantastic festival. I was real impressed with it. The films were great. People were great. It's run by filmmakers, so they understand this a bit. So we won the audience award at that one, which is really nice to have that. It was important, that one, too, because that's where Marv lived. He built that car at Dixie, the college down there, and that's where we showed the film, was right there. So we took the car down there and everything. All the family was there. The Jenkins family is really nice.
Nice. It brought it back home a little bit.
Yeah, so I like to say that's a good premiere. We also had a Salt Lake premiere. There's a lot of premieres happen with these things. It's
not, yeah.
But the Salt Lake premiere was at Rose Wagner. That included the mayors from around here came to it. A lot of good people. We had the front end just filled with four GT racing cars. It was crazy. It's a lot of fun.
Nice. So do you think this movie would have been received better publicly if it was more of like a fictional piece, a little more Hollywood style?
Oh, yeah,
over
obviously.
The documentary?
You know, there's people in documentaries, you know, they only go so far. It's kind of sad because we did really well and we're doing great. So for a documentary, we're doing fantastic. But it is kind of sad. Things are kind of getting homogenized into this more of super crazy, high-budget action flicks and then television shows, reality-based. That's really what's pushing the other direction against documentaries. It's kind of a tough thing in distribution as well, facing that. It's all about video on demand now, internet. That's kind of the future of this, which is great. We're kind of on this great edge right now, pioneering the new way of distributing. We're right there, and I think we're seeing that. You know, we'll be on iTunes. It can pop up any day. We have deals with them. We're on Amazon, all sorts of places. Best way is to buy it on DVD on our website. It's usually the the best way to get you get in a day or two.
Yeah.
So.
What are you hoping that the viewers will take away from this film? What's the overall feel-good story or, you know,
I think
lesson
that's it,
learned?
Is a feel-good story. A lot of documentaries, they tell a story that needs to be told, like this one. This is historical, but some of them get, you'd only watch them once. They're kind of depressing. It's like, oh man, that was great and all, but I don't ever want to see that again. I feel terrible. And those win Academy Awards are great and all. This, you walk out of saying, I'd like to have that one in my library. I want to show the kids this. I want to show relatives this. It gives a good message, like I said, a father-son story, where you watch a family keep the legacy. They keep moving. It keeps going forward. And then you see a man like John Price taking this. He's a man who could buy a car like this, you know, fix it up, sell it again, make a bazillion dollars on it, and off it goes somewhere in Japan. But he kept the integrity. He decided, I'm going to keep this thing in Utah, like he promised Marv and the Jenkins family. I'm going to let the people of Utah see this, and I'm going to do it right. And he did a great job with that. So you see that in the film as well. And you also get the really cool thing is you get to see all that old footage in the 1930s and such of cars on the salt flats for the first time. Now you see that all the time on television. You see car commercials and you see movies. This is the first stuff.
Okay.
So it's pretty cool.
So why do you feel that the story of Bonneville was one that needed to be told?
Bonneville, not so much just Bonneville, but the story of Ab Jenkins and the guys who raced out there. Back then they did it, and even today, but back then mostly, they did it not just for, I want to go faster, because it's neat, you know, wow, cool. They're doing it for reasons of engineering, safety. The evolution of the automobile happened, you know, obviously in the first part of the 20th century. And that's what this is all about. And Ab raced, he was doing it for safety of tires, trying to figure out with Firestone, with the actual Firestone person himself, how to build a better tire for everyone he's driving on the road, how to build safer brakes, how to build better engines, although the Meteor 3 isn't that, aerodynamics. Yeah. Everything came into play. So it's really what it's all about, more than just racing around.
Yeah, a little bit of history told
but
through
it's
his story.
It's important too to push forward and see how you can push engineering and yourself. This is a man who had raced 24 straight hours in the early 30s without, in the Pierce Arrow days before the Meteors, he'd race 24 hours without getting out of that thing. He'd stop for gas, he'd only drink milk and orange juice, and that's it.
That's incredible.
And sometimes 48 hours at times, 170 miles an hour, almost hitting 200 miles an hour all night long. There's no lights out there either. They had lights in the car and they used little oil lamps that would burn on this 10-mile course in circles all day and night. Insane.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Pushing the limits of man and machine.
So we could purchase the movie from the website, boysofbonneville.com, right?
Exactly.
Any other places
you
can view or purchase?
Right now, throughout the summer, you can go up to the University of Utah Museum of Fine Arts. There are 19 cars up there that are all significant from around the world to history and racing. I would encourage everybody to see that because the cars that are in this film are there. There are three cars of Ab Jenkins, the Meteor 1, the Meteor 3, and one of his Cords that he raced in the Stevens Cup back in Indianapolis for 24 hours. I would suggest you go do that. The movie is up there at the gift shop as well. Those are the two best places to buy it. Otherwise, go online if you want to download it. Like I said, Amazon. It may pop up on Netflix soon, as well as on iTunes and such, to keep your eyes open.
Yeah, I want to check out that exhibit.
It is amazing.
It's pretty amazing.
Beautiful cars in there. So a good chunk of those are John Price's cars as well. We have some events going on throughout the summer up there with Jay Leno. He's coming out on the 14th of July to give a lecture and have an open engine display of the car. So they lift the hoods on all the cars and you can see the engines, which is pretty cool too.
Yeah.
But that's a paid event. You can go on to the UMFA website and check out the details for that.
What you got currently in the works and what we can look forward to seeing from you next?
There are a couple of things. Another documentary on land speed stuff of all things. Imagine that. This one is on a motorcycle. Back in the 1960s, that was the fastest motorcycle in the world. It's about the man who designed it, mostly about what he did throughout the 20th century. He was the man who pushed aerodynamics in the car industry, worked for Ford, he designed the Tucker cars. This gyronaut motorcycle looks like a rocket ship. It's a streamliner situation that went, the driver told me the other day, he went over 300 miles an hour in that in 1970. When he did that run, he went down to 275 on that run, and the front end broke, flipped in the air, and ripped his arm apart. His arm is still messed up, but it's back in 1970. So that's really what we're doing right now. Then I've got other things that I do. I'm a director of photography for it, so I shoot television commercials and such. But I'm doing London Olympics. I'll be working on, I believe, wrestling of all things.
Oh, nice.
And judo. And then I'm off to Alaska to do a video for a lodge up in Juneau. And then we'll see where things go. We'll be back on all these documentaries, some other stuff I'm helping out with.
Sounds good. Is there anything else we should know before we let you go?
Go up to the UMFA as soon as possible. Some of the cars might rotate out of there.
Okay.
So this is the time, if you want to see those meteors, this is when you want to do it, right now. I would also suggest try to see the movie before, which is pretty cool because then you'll understand what these cars are. And it's kind of fun to see them on screen, and then there you're sitting there with the actual real thing. These are the rarest cars in the world. These are probably the most expensive cars now in the world too, so you get a kick out of it. Also, we are going to try to get this film made into a narrative film.
Okay.
So that's being pitched down in Hollywood right now. I'd like to see another big film come here, and I'm sure the Film Commission would too. It would have to be filmed on the Salt Flats, which is great.
Yeah.
It could bring a lot of business into here, and it's a great story for that. We're just pushing hard right now, so we'll see what happens. So keep your eyes open, and maybe it'll happen.
The next showing of Boys of Bonneville is Wednesday, July 18th at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts as part of their Speed exhibition. Located at 410 Campus Center Drive, the film begins at 7 p.m. For more info on the film, visit their official website, boysofbonneville.com. Thanks for listening to another edition of Sound Waves from the Underground. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. What are your favorite local albums from 2012 so far? What's the one song from a Utah band you can't stop listening to this year? Feel free to drop us a line and tell us your favorites for our upcoming local music panel. You can either send an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We may just play you on the show. A quick side note, for all those who have already subscribed to and rated us on iTunes, thanks. For those who haven't, if you enjoy the show, please take a moment of your time and give us a rating. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and is produced by Gavin Sheehan, with associate producers Jeanette D. Moses, Ricky Vigil, Esther Moronio, and Jonathan Paxton. Our executive producer is Angela H. Brown. Our theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. Our main logo and art design is by T. Doan, and technical design by Kate O'Connor. On next week's episode, a panel discussion about local music thus far and this year with Slug's editorial team.